Hey guys, welcome back to the Neuro Experience Podcast. Before we get into it, if you have 30 seconds, I'd be eternally grateful if you could go and leave a review on Apple iTunes. It literally takes 30 seconds. We're trying to push this out to more people. So if you enjoy the episode, if you enjoy the podcast, please go through and spend 30 seconds writing a review.
When you go to sleep and you have that extra drop in body temperature, your thermostat is being set to a lower level. And what the thermostat is doing is telling you, dump heat. And if you're in a warm environment, that's hard to do. So this drive to dump heat, this sensation that you're overheated, that's disrupting sleep. Now, why is a cold environment better? So as our work has shown, our major areas of heat loss are the palms of the hands, the soles of the feet, and the upper part of the face. If you're in a cold environment, it's easy to lose heat. You just stick your hands out or you stick your feet out.
My guest today is Dr. Craig Heller. He's a professor of biology at Stanford University and a world expert on the science of temperature regulation. In this episode, Dr. Heller explains how heat impairs muscular and mental performance. We talk about how to cool the brain and body to reduce inflammation and how to enhance performance with temperature protocols. Dr. Heller teaches us the best ways to cool our body down during performance and how to use the precise timing and location of cooling on our body to greatly enhance endurance and weight training performance. He describes how cooling technology discovered and engineered in his laboratory has led to a tripling of anaerobic performance and allowed endurance athletes to run further and faster. We also talk about how to eliminate delayed onset muscle soreness. If you're interested in understanding the science behind cold water immersion, ice baths, and how training in the cold weather is useful, then this episode is for you. Without further delay, here is Dr. Craig Heller. Welcome to the Neuro Experience Podcast, where you will learn the science of human performance and optimization. This episode is brought to you by 8 Sleep. And funnily enough, Craig Heller is a huge 8 Sleep fan and actually sleeps on one, as do I. Team, in 1942, the average person slept 7.9 hours per night. Today, the average person sleeps 6 hours and 31 minutes. Sleeping less than 7 hours per night increases your risk of diabetes, depression, weight gain, cancer, and Alzheimer's disease. For these reasons, I choose to optimize my temperature while I sleep, and that is why I sleep on an 8 Sleep Pod Pro cover. The pod is the only sleep technology that dynamically cools and heats each side of the bed to maintain the optimal sleeping temperature for what your body needs. With the pod, you can start sleeping as cool as 55 degrees Fahrenheit or as hot as 110 degrees Fahrenheit. 8 Sleep conducts research on the effects of their pods, and the data shows that 8 Sleep users experience up to 19% increase in recovery, a 32% improvement in sleep quality, and up to 34% more deep sleep. With more deep sleep, I myself can be confident that my mind and my body are moving through the restorative sleep stages that are vital for physical recovery, hormone regulation, and mental clarity. Even better, guys, 8 Sleep has just launched the next generation of the pod. It's the new Pod 3. This enables more accurate sleep and health tracking with double the amount of sensors, delivering you the best sleep experience on earth. Just go to 8sleep.com/neuro for exclusive Labor Day savings through to September 11th. 8 Sleep currently ships within the US, Canada, the UK, select countries in the EU, and of course, Australia. That's 8sleep.com/neuro. Craig, it's so wonderful to finally have you on the podcast. I've been following you and your work for quite some time, and this area of cold and cold thermogenesis and cooling is so applicable to everything that I do and that I study. So I think the first question where I want to kick things off is around cooling for performance. There is this huge market now for cold plunges. So why don't we get into what cooling does or what cold does to the body and how it can affect performance?
Okay, well, I guess the most important discovery that we've made in the course of this work is that a major cause of muscle failure, which is the same as muscle fatigue, is the rise in temperature of the muscle. Now, if you're doing anaerobic work, like lifting or sprinting, the major temperature that's of concern is the temperature of the muscle being used, the large dynamic muscle. When you're doing endurance work, that heat has an opportunity to be distributed around the body, and therefore it's the overall body temperature, which is eventually generating a problem. So if you're doing lifting, you may not experience any dramatic change in your core body temperature, but your muscles that are being used in that heavy work, they are generating a lot of heat. And that heat only gets out of the muscle in the blood. And when the muscle's contracting, the blood flow is restricted. So the muscle temperature will rise, even though the overall body temperature doesn't seem to be rising that much. And we live on the edge of heat damage. Our average core temperature is maybe 37 degrees. If we get to 39, we begin to lose functionality, including cognition. And when you get to above 40, you are on the verge of heat illness, heat stroke, rhabdomyolysis, because the muscles can be much hotter than the overall body temperature. So that upper range that we experience in heavy exercise and working in hot environments, that upper range is quite critical.
It's funny that you say that, because we, you know, there used to be this myth around lactic acid and lactate being the thing that is stopping us from progressing. And you know how when you're cycling hard and you feel that burn, and, you know, there's all these marketing products now aimed at trying to get rid of or eliminate that lactic acid. So what you're saying is that's actually not what's happening. It is just the heating up of the muscles.
Yeah, we're actually studying that right now. And it's been proven mainly by work of George Brooks at Berkeley that lactate is not a cause of fatigue. He's been able to elevate blood lactate levels by infusion, and it does not affect fatigue. What we've been showing is that it's the opposite. The fatigue causes lactate. Not that lactate causes fatigue. And what I mean by that is when the muscle gets to that critical temperature, it shuts off. And that process of shutting off results in a production of lactate. I won't get into that biochemistry right now, but the lactate threshold, the work level at which you begin to see a rise in lactate in the blood, it's a function of temperature. That if someone starts exercising at a high temperature, their lactate threshold is much lower.
Okay, so then how does this work for endurance athletes or just during aerobic or anaerobic physical activity? If somebody is training, let's just say they're not in a competition, what is it better to cool prior to a workout or in between a workout? What's the best mode of cooling down then?
Well, it depends on what methodology you're using. So if you use our methodology, which is extraction of heat from the palmar surfaces or the soles of the feet or the upper part of the face, that's thermostatically controlled. So you can't pull someone below normal body temperature. What you can do is you can... for example, our cross-country team has used this strategy. If they're competing in a very hot location, they may do their warm-up first, and then they will extract the heat before the beginning of the race. And what they're doing there is they're increasing the capacity of the overall body to absorb the excess heat. So, you know, our body's not, all parts of our body are not at the same temperature. So if you are in a cool environment and you haven't worked out, it's only the very core of your body that's at 37. So you have a huge capacity to absorb excess heat as you bring your overall body temperature up.
Wow, that's really fascinating, because there was, you know, another myth or a notion that, you know, if you get into a cold bath immediately following exercise, it helps, you know, it helps with recovery and blocking inflammation. However, now I'm seeing that I don't know where to sit. Is it good to go and do a hard workout and then jump in an ice bath, or is it good to just wait 2 hours post-exercise to then get into the ice bath?
Well, what the ice bath is doing is it's preventing inflammation. That's the major function. And I would say the sooner you do it, the better. But an ice bath is not absolutely necessary. if you can use the Palmer cooling during your workout or immediately after, you'll come back down from that high body temperature very quickly. And the faster you recover, the more you're refreshed, the more you're energized. Now, there's something that I hypothesize that I don't have proof for, but what we find with our technology is that when people use it and achieve work volumes much higher than they normally would, they always say, "I'm going to be so sore tomorrow," and they never are. And I think there's a relationship between high temperature and the inflammation that results from it. And I think the mechanism, I have absolutely no proof for this. I'd love to get a molecular biologist, biochemist to look into it. But one of the function, when you overheat tissues, it expresses what are called heat shock proteins. And one of the things that these heat shock proteins do is they prevent the expression of other genes. You don't want to be producing new proteins in an environment where they won't fold correctly and be active. So I think what is happening by preventing the excessive rise and the duration of the rise in temperature is you're suppressing the expression of those heat shock genes. So as a result, the genes necessary for repair of the muscle are not inhibited. They're not blocked. So you get more effective repair during your post-exercise recovery. Once again, it's a hypothesis. I don't have any proof for it, but the thing that is absolutely true is that if you keep your temperature from rising too high, too long, during excessive workouts, you do decrease the delayed onset muscle soreness.
So is there a particular time that you should be immersing yourself in water to get these effects?
Well, the issue there is the convenience. You don't have, you can't jump in a water bath between different sets of an activity or different, if you're on sides or off sides, the court in a game. So the main benefit of the cold immersion is just decreasing the overall inflammation. Okay. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is if you cool regularly, you prevent those excessive increases in muscle temperature. You prevent the inflammation to begin with.
Oh, okay. So what about when you immerse yourself in cold water in a cold tub? I know that you release other things, such as you get, I think, I don't know what the percentage was, but I think I read somewhere that you get a 250% increase in norepinephrine. So are you able to discuss what this is and how this is beneficial to us?
Well, norepinephrine is the neurotransmitter of the sympathetic nervous system. This is the fight or flight nervous system. this is what gets you going. You know, if all of a sudden you're walking on a path and you see a rattlesnake, you get a big shot of adrenaline and noradrenaline. So these are neurotransmitters that are involved in the sympathetic nervous system. They get you ready for emergencies. Okay. So anything that is highly alerting is going to cause an increase in sympathetic nervous system activity. So one of the techniques, which is very popular now, which I can't recommend, is the cryotherapy. And people say, oh, well, I feel different. I feel really good. Well, of course, you've given yourself a shot of adrenaline.
Yeah, pretty much.
And that's what happens if you jump into a tub of ice water or you go into one of these cryotherapy chambers. You're getting a shot of adrenaline. So it's just your normal autonomic nervous system responding to a change in situations.
Yeah, I mean, I guess then this is why a lot of people are taking their cold showers, a 2-minute cold shower first thing in the morning to kind of wake them up, get them vigilant, right. Get them focused, get them ready for the day, which is great. However, I never knew if a cold shower was cold enough. You know, I didn't know if, because obviously you can't get the cold shower down to 8 degrees Celsius. So is a cold shower?
No, I don't think you'd want to.
No, I don't think you'd want to. But then what's the other option? Is it filling your bathtub up with ice, or is it, you know, investing in a cold plunge to get these effects?
I would just say, you know, you can do what you think is good for you, but there's no physiological basis for it other than just alerting. So it gets you up to the point where you're maximally ready for anything that comes at you. So I can't see that it's going to affect your performance. Now, the one thing that it could do is that, as I said, you have this capacity in your overall body mass to absorb heat. So if you're going to be doing an endurance activity and you cool down first, the benefit will be increasing your scope for absorbing that excess heat. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a downside, however, and that is one particular enzyme which is essential for getting fuel into your mitochondria, and that's how you fuel your muscles. The mitochondria produce ATP. Now, one of the enzymes that is critical for getting the fuel into the mitochondria has a very steep a temperature optimum. So if you have a really cold limb, a leg, for example, you're not going to be able to get the maximum power out of it. So that's why we have warm-ups. I mean, warm-ups are probably the major benefit is increased flexibility to prevent muscle tears and tendon damage. But the other thing that the warm-up does is it brings this enzymatic system for getting fueled into the mitochondria close to optimum. But then, as the temperature goes up a little bit more, it crashes. And that's when you can't do another rep. That's when you have muscle failure.
Wow, that's interesting. That's such a fine line then between cooling and warming up. So you can't get too cold during an event, but you also can't get overheated because you'll stop.
Right. We live on the thermal edge.
We should get t-shirts with that on it. Okay. So what about when it comes to post-concussive hits? Okay. Let's just say an NFL player. I know that there's a lot of people, especially down in Australia. In fact, I think Griffith University are doing a study around, they're getting a lot of, we don't have the NFL, but a lot of rugby league players who have just been hit in the head. They pull them off and they cool down their neck with some sort of cooling device to see if that can offset some of the post-concussive symptoms. And I know during a concussion, the temperature of your brain is rising. And correct me if I'm wrong. So that would mean that if we can cool it down after a hit, that would be advantageous. Is that correct?
Well, certainly, just like another part of your body, you can counter, to a certain extent, the inflammation by cooling. And it is quite controversial as to the extent to which cooling can prevent neural damage. But I don't take that terribly seriously. This is a condition we can't do experiments on very easily. You treat people as they come, and then, as is true of most clinical research, you then can accumulate information and data. What happened when you did this? What happened when you did that? That's different from having controlled experiments in which you have everything the same, and then you are looking at one condition versus another. But certainly it can't hurt. And the reason for cooling the neck is that you are cooling the four main blood vessels which are taking arterial blood to the brain. So it's a good way of cooling the brain. Now, the other thing that you may say, well, why not do that during exercise? Okay. And there's a reason for that, and we can have an analogy with the home thermostat, right? The home thermostat is sensitive to its temperature. The thermostat in your brain is sensitive to its temperature, okay? So if you actually cool the brain selectively and your body is overheated, you're going to shut off your heat loss. You're going to shut off the air conditioner, okay? It's like if you put a wet washcloth over your thermostat, you're going to turn off the air conditioner.
Yeah.
Is that a good way to cool the house? No. So there is a downside of cooling selectively the brain. You actually have an influence on the thermostat. So if you're overheated, if you went down with a concussion when you're in the midst of play and your core temperature is high, one of the downsides is you're going to decrease the rate at which your body will dump heat.
Okay, so
that's another reason why, you know, it's not advisable to use things like cold vests during activity, because what the cold vest is actually doing is changing the setting on your thermostat so that it's harder to lose heat.
Wow. I mean, my next question around that was, well, then couldn't we then cool the neck for stroke patients, somebody who you know is having a stroke? Couldn't you go through and then try and cool their neck down?
Yes.
As well?
Well, if someone's having a stroke, cooling is extremely, extremely valuable. That's been demonstrated in experiments on animals in which strokes can be controlled and induced by just clogging a particular artery in the brain. And cooling the brain dramatically decreases the eventual damage. But the critical thing is soon. So you get the most benefit if the cooling is right away, which is not possible if it's a human stroke case, because they have to call the medics, call the ambulance, and so forth. So the maximum benefit is within the first hour of
that's
the...
They call that the golden hour.
Right. And then you get farther out, you may get some effect, but much less.
But you mentioned, you know, it took, you know, they have to call the ambulance and go to the hospital. But how would somebody do this at home if they had this information? Somebody's stroking out. Can you cool down the brain at home with a cool pack on your neck?
I don't think that would ever come out as an FDA approved method, because the diagnosis is absolutely critical. So is it, for example, an ischemic stroke or is it a hemorrhagic stroke?
Yeah.
There may be differences there. So I can't comment on that. I'm not a physician.
Well, while we're on the area of the brain, when it comes to cognition, okay, because you mentioned fatigue, and we spoke about fatigue in the body, but how about all of these people who are working these hard jobs, these portfolio managers that I see over on Wall Street? They've got mental fatigue. They're getting brain fog. They can't focus. Would cooling have an effect in these areas of performance as well, in the area of mental performance?
That's a good question. And certainly, you're not performing as well when you're overheated. The question is, to what extent is the activity of a portfolio manager raising the brain temperature? I don't know. I think there's probably other factors which are playing a role. I mean, we can actually tire local areas of our brain. That's been definitely shown in humans, that if you work one particular part of your brain, let's say you do a left-hand activity, okay, then in subsequent sleep, the sleep intensity over that part of the cortex is greater. And the improvement in performance the next day is proportional to that increase in sleep intensity. So there are multiple ways of fatiguing neural tissue other than just the temperature. Whether lowering temperature would help, I don't know.
Interesting. All right. Let's talk about my favorite topic, which is sleep. And okay. I know you have a bit of an interest in that too. So I want to talk first with this statement, and that is, what we know from the scientific literature is that in order to fall asleep and stay asleep, our core body temperature needs to drop at least 2 degrees. So, I mean, you can argue against that if that's not correct, but I'd like to know
why. You're talking about Fahrenheit.
Fahrenheit, yes.
Fahrenheit, yes. Yeah.
Fahrenheit.
Yeah. That's a pretty big drop, 2 degrees, yeah. But yeah, sure. It's over the course of the night from your high during the day to your low at night, about 2 degrees.
I want to talk about why. Why does our core body temperature, and this is different because people get mixed up with core body temperature and ambient temperature. You know, they're messing right. around with the thermostat, and that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about our core body temperature. Why does it need to drop for us to have a great REM sleep and deep sleep?
Well, that's a good question. And I'd have to say that we don't know.
Okay.
There is a hypothesis, and that hypothesis is that it is a significant savings in energy. So when you're inactive, you're not being called upon to get up and run around or to do a particular job. Why spend that extra energy that is associated with a higher temperature? So extending that argument, or sort of some sort of basis for thinking that way, are animals that are energy deprived. Let's say hummingbirds, who have a very high energy demand and very tiny little bodies, and they will drop their body temperature at night when they're sleeping. And think of animals that hibernate. I mean, hibernation is really an extension of sleep. And the only function you can say for hibernation is that it's to save energy. You're conserving energy to be able to last the whole winter long. So a hypothesis that's been around for a long time is that the major reason for the drop in temperature is energy conservation. It is simply an adaptation which is carried through in all mammals and birds. So we don't know, okay? But I could turn your question around and say, well, why, if temperature is high, we don't sleep as well? And the answer to that is that when you go to sleep and you have that extra drop in body temperature, your thermostat is being set to a lower level. And what the thermostat is doing is telling you, dump heat, dump heat. And if you're in a warm environment, that's hard to do. So this drive to dump heat, this sensation that you're overheated, that's disrupting sleep. Now, why is a cold environment better? So as our work has shown, our major areas of heat loss are the palms of the hands, the soles of the feet, and the upper part of the face. If you're in a cold environment, it's easy to lose heat. You just stick your hands out,
yeah.
or you stick your feet out, or you turn your head on the pillow to a cooler place. Okay. If you're in a hot environment, you can't do that. So the drive to lower body temperature is disruptive to sleep. Now, you experience the same thing if you have a fever and you go to bed and your fever is going up and you're cold and you're shivering, and then you take an aspirin. Well, 10 minutes later, you wake up in a pool of sweat because the aspirin has lowered your set point. And that's a more extreme case than the normal daily change in temperature, but it's the same phenomenon.
So then you can get benefits from setting the thermostat in your bedroom, let's just say, to a cooler temperature. And
yeah, if you have a cooler temperature, you're more comfortable with it. You have the covers, you have the blankets,
yeah.
So that's not a problem, right?
Yeah.
But you can just take them off, put them on.
Interesting. Well, I sleep on a temperature controlled mattress. So yeah. It does the work for me. I don't have to worry about the thermostat.
Right. Right. Sure.
Okay. So something else that's really interesting in this area is this phenomenon of getting in a cold bath to activate our brown fat, to potentially lose some fat, you know.
Yep, sure. Yeah.
What does that all mean? Because a lot of people listening are probably like, what do you mean I have brown fat and white fat? Like, what's the difference? And what does cold have to do with it?
Well, you have brown fat, you have white fat. And you all know what white fat is. It's a storage organ. It stores energy. Okay. And sometimes we just store too much. What brown fat is another form of fat, and its major function is to produce heat. So most tissues of the body produce heat as a byproduct of their metabolism. And when you contract a muscle, okay, you get heat production because of the work that that muscle's doing. Now, what brown fat does is brown fat can generate heat without doing work. It uncouples the metabolism of, or the oxidation of the fuel, the fat, from the production of ATP. We call it, you know, uncoupling of oxidative phosphorylation, for a big word. Okay. So brown fat is a value to a newborn because they're coming from a very temperature regulated incubator into the real world. So they have to all of a sudden increase their heat production, and brown fat is a significant adaptation for many species that in the newborn. Brown fat is important for animals that hibernate because it gives them the ability to come out of hibernation by generating enormous amounts of heat. And when a hibernator is at a very low temperature, its muscles don't work very well, so it can't shiver, but it can activate its brown fat. Now, it was thought for a long time that humans, especially adult humans, don't have brown fat because in the hibernators and the newborn, the brown fat is identifiable anatomically. There are pads, there are areas where the brown fat is located. But it turns out in humans, it's much more distributed. So you don't have discrete pads of brown fat, but the brown fat is sort of distributed along with other tissues. Now, the percentage or the amount of brown fat you have is hypothesized to play a role in how efficiently you deal with overnutrition. So in other words, if you have more brown fat, you're converting more of it to heat without doing work, and therefore it's less likely to be deposited as white fat.
Well, as a percentage, then, what does the average adult have in terms of brown to white fat, and where is it stored? Oh, you wouldn't know. That's so intense.
I don't know what the percentage would vary. It's not huge. but it has very high capacity for burning fuel.
So we can potentially induce this by getting into cold baths.
No, I don't think so. I don't know for sure. I don't know if this has ever been studied, whether the abundance of brown fat in humans changes with environment, whether or not people living in the cold have more brown fat than people not living in the cold. I don't know the answer to that.
That's really interesting. How about what
you would do in cold bath is you would activate the brown fat, because you talked about that increased sympathetic output. Well, it's that sympathetic output that turns on the brown fat, which increases the metabolism of the brown fat.
That's interesting. So then you could say somewhat that being in a more cool state could potentially help somebody in their weight loss interventions.
But it has to be coupled with not an increase of intake.
Yeah.
So, no, we're very good at regulating our intake to match what we're losing. And it's just the balance of the intake and the utilization over long periods of time. So, yeah, we may feel good if we miss lunch one day, but then that night at dinner, we might eat a little bit more.
Calories in and calories out, Dr.
Right,
Miller. That's
right.
What I think it is. Right. What about in the case of neurodegenerative diseases? Is there any links there that you have found, whether it's Alzheimer's disease, dementia, as it relates to thermogenesis, either hot or cold?
No, we haven't looked at that. And I don't know. I'm sort of searching my mind. I can't think of any studies. I've recently become, one of the conditions that we work on here in our neurobiology is Down syndrome. And I have run into some accounts that individuals with Down syndrome tend to run hot. They tend to have higher body temperatures, higher skin temperatures. I haven't had a chance to look into that. But even if it's true, I don't know what the significance of it is.
So what is your lab now focusing on? What's your next area of focus?
Well, there are two areas that we work on. One is the role of sleep and circadian rhythms on learning and memory. And that's where the Down syndrome work is located right now, because we find that if we potentiate sleep, and if we, in the experimental animals, if we disrupt their circadian patterns, we can improve learning and memory. As a matter of fact, for our mouse models of Down syndrome, we found a pharmacological treatment that normalizes their learning and memory. And that's quite exciting. Then the other area of research has to do with the human temperature regulation and our ability to improve performance by controlling the core body temperature and specifically temperatures of muscles. We are now looking at the role of temperature in lactate production, as I mentioned, as we think lactate is probably a biomarker of fatigue. It's not causing fatigue, but it's a biomarker of fatigue. And then showing that we can eliminate or decrease that appearance of lactate by heat extraction. So if we continuously extract heat from people who are working, we can increase their work volume. We can decrease the rise of lactate in the blood. So those are the sorts of things that we're looking at now, and we're working to improve our technology for heat extraction, making it less expensive, making it easier to use, making it more effective.
What technology is it?
Well, you can find it at coolmit.com. COOLMITT.com. And essentially what it is, it's a method for extracting heat from the palm of your hand. So one hand or two hands. Let's say you do a set of pull-ups, the muscle failure, stick your hand in, get rid of that extra heat for a minute to 2 minutes, 3 minutes maybe, and go back and do it again.
So you can take a cooling mitts.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we've had, for example, NFL football players come in who are really, really fit, at peak fitness for their careers, and have them pick an activity they're good at or that they like, whether it's pull-ups or dips or something like that. And then between one day with their normal activity, their normal set to exhaustion, and then a couple days later do it with the Palmer cooling between reps, we can double their work volume. Wow. And if you do this over time, you get an incredible conditioning effect. So can triple it. So had, for example, one NFL player who liked to do dips. He said he can do 40 dips in his first set. He can do 5 sets each set, fewer and fewer dips. So the very first day he tried it with cooling, he doubled his work volume. And then doing it twice a week for 4 weeks, I think it was, he reached a tripling.
Would this then have an effect on delayed onset muscle soreness?
No muscle soreness.
Wow.
He
so
was
this
able
is
to
like
commit
a magic pill.
I think it's just preventing inflammation.
Okay. So you think what's actually happening from a molecular standpoint is you're just during that stage, let's just say he's done the first set of dips, and then you are completely blocking that inflammation. Well, not completely blocking, but you're decreasing
right.
the amount of inflammation.
Right. But the reason that we're increasing the work volume is we're eliminating the fail-safe mechanism that keeps us from damaging our muscles from overheating. So when we shut down, when the muscle failure occurs, that's a protective response. It keeps us from doing more work, generating more heat, and damaging the muscle. So by taking that heat out, we're removing that red flag. We're removing that fail-safe mechanism. We're not removing it. The fail-safe mechanism is there. We're avoiding it. We're not getting to that threshold.
I guess this would work for anybody. You don't have to be an elite athlete. This could work on parents, for example, who are by far not elite athletes. I have to beg them to go into the gym. But, this could work on my mother, for example.
Well, it's true, but it has to be someone who is at least approaching heat limitations.
Okay.
So if you're a couch potato and you can only do one push-up, it's not going to help you. If you are at the point where you are generating a significant amount of heat and that's the limiting factor, then it will help you. So I've had some freshman women, not athletes, but I've had some freshman women doing over 800 push-ups.
Oh, wow.
So it doesn't have to be a professional athlete.
Well, where does strength come into this? Because I know for me, sometimes it's not body temperature, I feel. It is just lack of strength that may get me to the 800 push-up mark.
Well, that's what I'm talking about with muscle failure.
Okay.
Your muscle cannot produce another contraction. That is muscle failure.
Wow. Okay.
You if you're hanging from the bar and you can't get back up again, that's muscle failure. If you're doing a push-up and you can't get your nose off the floor, that's muscle failure.
So how about if you're training in the winter? So I live in New York City. It gets extremely cold. What if I'm training, and it's January and it's super cold outside? Is this still the same
thing?
Well,
effect? You can do more. You probably know this. You can do much more when it's cold than when it's hot.
It's hard to get going.
A very good example. In the Athens Olympic, the women's marathon, we expected Paula Rudolph to win. She was a world champion, women's marathon runner. She had to drop out a couple miles before the end of the race due to heat stress. That same year, she won the New York Marathon, and two subsequent years, she won the New York Marathon. The difference was that Athens on that day was 95 degrees Fahrenheit, and the average temperature in New York for those three New York marathons was 45 degrees. So, I mean, it's a very common experience. You exhaust quicker in hot weather. In cold weather, you can go more.
Okay, so where are these mitts, and are they available to the general public?
Well, you can look it up at coolmitt.com.
Okay.
And right now, I think they're struggling with supply chain issues, but they have a sign-up list where you can put your name down, and when they're available, you can get one.
Well, I just want to thank you for coming on the Neuro Experience podcast. I think that you are definitely changing the world when it comes to cooling and performance, cooling and sleeping. And I'm super excited to see what your future studies show and prove.
Thank you, Louisa. It was great talking with you. And I wish you the best in all of your endeavors.